Stay busy, stay working. I've taught me, like, the key to this joint, the key to stay on top of things is to treat everything like it's your first project, you know what I'm saying? Like it's your first day, like how I went in as an intern. Like, that's how you try to treat things, like, just stay hungry.
Y'all wanna know why you don't stop? Y'all wanna know why you don't flop? Let me tell you people why. I came from the bottom of the block. When I was born, it was sworn I was never gonna be shit. Had to prove the opposite. I was bitch, had to get my pride on. I feel the pride, Sean knew I had to get these chips. Had to make moves like Elijah Wan. Started out selling dimes and nicks. Graduated to a brick, no exaggeration. My infatuation with the strip. Legendary like a schoolboy. Crush a million in every chick. Heavy shit. That's how schoolboy got whipped and got left on some chest. Me, myself, and I on some true boy shit. Had to voice to a place up, to a place of no return. Had to play with fire and get burned. Only way the boy ever gonna learn. Had to lay way in the cut till I finally got my turn. Now I'm on top in the spot that I earned. It's my life. It's my pain and my struggle. The song that I sing to you is my everything. Treat my first like my last, and my last like my first, and my first is the same as when I came. It's my joy and my tears, and the laughter it brings to me is my everything. Like I never rode in a limo, like I just dropped flows to a demo. Like it's 92 again, and I got O's in a rental. Back in the stool again, no problem. It's a whole lot simple when you think back. You thought that you would never make it this far. Then you take advantage of the luck you handed, of the talent you've been given. Ain't no half seven, ain't no slipping. Ain't no different from a block that's hitting. Gotta get it while the getting's good. Gotta strike while the iron's hot. When you stop, then you gotta fit it. Good riddance, goodbye. This is my second major breakup. My first was with a pager, with a hoopty, a cook pot, and a game. This one's with the stew, with the spade, with the fortune. Maybe not the fortune, but certainly my life. My pain and my struggle, the song that I sing to you is my everything. Treat my first like my last, and my last like my first, and my first is the same as when I came. It's my joy and my tears and my laughter it brings to me. It's my everything. Treat my first like my last and my last like my first and my first like the first song I sang. Woo! It's like the blues. Gonna ride out on this one. Ta-ta, be high. Yo, I remember you was making them dances for them niggas at radio and shit. Clark Kent. I was good looking out, nigga. Carlene. Whoever thought we'd make it this far, homie. Shot. They can't stop us. You know what I'm saying? Vinny, yes. Dane, what up? Robbing the bank. Niggas thought we was crazy, man. Remember, you had that fucked up ass handwriting. You was writing all the numbers that we was spending now for yes. Videos you're doing ourselves. Ski, what up? Original flavor now. Your accountant was crazy wrong and shit. But we still put it together. Biggs, what's up? We went to St. Thomas and John Manila. Your dog peed on homie leg and shit at his crib. I think that was Ruby. And they was having a little trouble with the pool. You and Ty was laughing. Emery was there. What up, Emery? What up, Ty? Hip-hop, what up, man? Hey, Hop, you ain't have no, you ain't had no motherfucking seat on your bicycle. Now you, head of black music. That's what I'm talking about right there, homie. What up, G? Yes, sir. Hey, buddy, bro. Hey, Guru. I know you spoiled, man. I be taking them shits in one take. You don't have to punch nigga shit. Nigga, you gonna be tight. OG, Juan, what up? I'm a little upset that you wasn't involved in this whole process, but it's all good. What's up, Dash? My whole family, my nephew, cousin Angie. What's up, TT? Mom, you made the album. How crazy is that? Babala, rest in peace. My pops, rest in peace. What's up, AJ? Biggie Smalls, rest in peace. Nigga, I'm about to go golfing, man. Hey, I might even have me a cappuccino. Fuck it. I'm going somewhere nice with no mosquitoes at, nigga.
Shaboy.
Yeah.
Inksta at CITR 101.9 FM from Vancouver, UBC.
British Columbia.
That was Jay-Z off the Black Album. Was that his supposed last album?
The what?
The Black Album.
Was it the last one?
Was that the one he said would be his last one,
Jay-Z? But you know, it's not.
That was my first song. And today, our special guest is Adrian Tomini. Did I pronounce it right? I'll find out in a sec. He is the author, creator, auteur of Optic Nerve and the ongoing series of Optic Nerve books, as well as the,
mini-comics.
Mini-comics, and also driving force behind the Yoshihiro Tatsumi collection.
And also an illustrator for The New Yorker.
There we go. So he's fancy and still street level. We got you there, Adrian?
Yep, I'm here.
Awesome. Did I pronounce it right? Tomine?
It's close enough. It's Tomina, but you know, I've heard it so many ways that nothing's really right or wrong at this point.
I'm notorious for mispronouncing names. In fact, pronouncing someone's name five different ways in an interview. And
yeah.
It's like a disability.
Well, you're bound to get one of them right, right? So
I didn't.
People always ask me in advance, like, before we go on air, how do you pronounce your last name? And then I tell them, and then 1 minute later they say it wrong. So, you know, it doesn't matter.
See, I'll be honest up front, and I'll
I'll be honest, I forgot how to pronounce it already.
Exactly. So why bother?
So, and just for our listeners, I am joined by Mariel Coe, host of We All Fall Down, CITR's own, I don't know, what is your show? It's like
eclectic.
Angry Angst.
Oh, I don't know.
That's on before me, who is also a comics reader and a fan of Adrian's work. So thank you for taking the time to join us, Adrian. I guess you're in the middle of a tour right now, if I'm not correct.
Yep, that's right. I'm still at pretty much the front end of it. I've done a few dates, and I'm actually back at home right now while we're talking. But I head out again tomorrow, and we'll be pretty much on the road until Thanksgiving.
The American Thanksgiving.
Yeah. That's right.
Ours is over.
I'm sorry. Going all the way back. Yeah, all the way to the
back in time. Yeah.
The amazing traveling comic creator. Yeah. And for people in Vancouver, Adrian will be here at Sophia Books on November 13th at 7 o'clock till 10 p.m. And I'll be mentioning that again and again. And also take a look online at drawingquarterly.com to find out where he's going to be in your local hood. So I guess we'll start with congratulations on your latest, is your first pseudo-epic, Shortcomings.
Yeah, right.
Would that be the best way to state it?
Yes, yeah, pseudo-epic is what I put on the back cover. File under.
Yeah. You're lying.
You know, in this
right beside Lord of the Rings.
Right. This era of packaging and marketing and everything, they have to call it a graphic novel because you'll instantly get more attention that way. So it's you know, the first longish story that I've done that can be packaged up nicely under one cover.
Now, this story kind of stands out separately from the rest of your work in a lot of different aspects because I find most of the other ones focus on one character.
Right.
This kind of goes deeply into the protagonist character, into Ben Tanaka's crumbling world,
Of his relationships with different people.
But yeah, his relationships to different people, but also like how that affects the other people involved as well.
Right.
And also the friend. So was this something, when you started doing it, setting out, was it a different book that you wanted to do compared to what you've done in the past?
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think that that example you cite of sort of trying to expand the focus beyond one character was one of the things that I had in mind. But some of my more critical readers will be surprised when I say this, but I think in a lot of ways I was trying to push myself and really try and at least take some tentative steps towards approaching things differently. And you know, I think that just the nature of the way I work and a lot of other cartoonists too is that you have to sort of aim very high in terms of what you hope to achieve or how much you want to change your work, and then the result is always falls quite a bit quite a bit short of that. But you know, how else are you going to make any progress, really?
Now, a big change between this one and other ones is you actually take on race as an issue within the story as well.
Yeah.
What was the choice with that compared to other stuff? Because, like, there are characters that are, you know, multi-ethnic and stuff, but this is the first time where it's like, bang, this right. is kind of a center feature.
Right. Well, I think going back in time a little bit, like when I first started getting published and doing some interviews, that was one of the first surprises I encountered, was that I'd get a lot of questions from journalists and from readers asking me about why I was intentionally hiding my ethnicity in my work, or why I wasn't addressing the big political issues at hand. And I think I was sort of taken aback by that, and I think at least at some point there was maybe just a bit of a rebellious response on my part to that expectation, where I felt like I just was hoping to be recognized as just a cartoonist, not a Japanese-American cartoonist necessarily. I tried to focus on more universal things for a while, but I think also that experience also might have even planted the seed in my mind of how could I maybe take on that challenge, but you know, still create work that I felt was consistent with other things that I've done, and that wasn't just such a obvious you know, kind of preachy soapbox and scream out some really obvious politically correct points. And so I think around, I don't know, 5 years ago when I started planning this book, I had some of those thoughts in the back of my mind. I'd sort of been accumulating some little anecdotes and ideas that I knew would somehow come together at some point. But I think concurrent with that, I was also starting to feel just really frustrated with my own, I guess, sort of just a very apparent influence that other cartoonists had had on my work. I mean, I had no formal training other than basically copying the work of cartoonists who I admired, and as a result, those influences have always been pretty apparent and oft commented upon. And so I think I was at that same time just trying to think of I found that I couldn't just snap my fingers and overnight develop a completely original visual approach, but I thought maybe I could sort of start to look inwards a bit in a different way and try and formulate a storyline and characters that were pretty specific to my own life and my own experiences, and maybe not the kind of thing that some of my cartooning heroes would ever do.
So this is kind of like something you've been working towards,
being able
to craft.
Yeah, I think that it would have been a big mistake for me to try and do this book even, you know, 10 years ago or more. I don't think this is the kind of book that I would have been able to make my big debut with. And, you know, it's still a fairly modest story. It's not a big, gigantic brick of a book, but it definitely to me feels like it was dependent upon the years of practice leading up to it.
I find it interesting that because of being Japanese American, you have that expectation from, like you're saying, in interviews and stuff, where people expect you to be covering that as a topic.
Right.
But like, meanwhile, other cartoonists, like, are you going to go and ask Ivan Brunetti what it's like to be an Italian American?
Yeah, I don't.
As a cartoonist. And...
Yeah. There might be. I mean, a lot of it came from within, I guess, my own minority group. So maybe there have been some Italian-American journalists who've gotten on Ivan's case about that. I don't know.
Now, kind of looking through your work and, you know, from the mini-comic days to the present work, it does seem like you've been working on kind of developing to the point where you could get to the shortcoming stories, where it's like you've kind of been expanding on your storytelling techniques, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I think that when I say that I sort of required the training from the previous years of cartooning to make this book, it's not exactly that I threw in everything that I've ever done before. A lot of this was kind of by reduction, by paring away, and I felt one of the other conscious choices that I made going into it was to strip away some of the devices that I felt like I'd become too dependent on. I specifically narration and thought bubbles, which are just a staple of cartooning and which I relied on quite a bit. And I was just feeling like I had sort of established some tiny bit of reputation as having sort of a literary flavor to some of my stories. And the more I thought about it, I thought, like, I could just blindly accept that compliment and be proud of myself. On the other hand, I could sort of analyze it a little more and think that maybe that's coming about because critics or readers who are more familiar with prose fiction find it easier to latch onto the prose narration that I've imposed upon these stories, where it's still something a little more familiar. And I just was sort of interested to see if I could pare some of that away and try and tell the story through more of the bare bones of cartooning, you know, just the simple interaction of dialogue and visuals.
And you've got, is it an English lit degree?
Yeah, I started out as an art major at Berkeley, and probably within the first day of classes felt like it wasn't the right major for me. And I was enjoying my English classes more than I expected, so I switched over to that.
What kind of written literature, non-comic literature, have you brought in to your kind of wealth of influences? Because, like, you're talking about using different kind of storytelling techniques and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it does seem like you're kind of stepping beyond the standard comic mechanisms, so to say.
It could be. I think that, if anything, my college years gave me a good sort of overview and sort of forced me to read a lot of literature that I never would have picked up on my own, and I imagine that can't hurt. I think, you know, my college professors would be sad to hear this, but I think for the most part, most of what's guided me has been other cartoonists and just my love of comics in general. And I think things like prose literature and film and other types of art are always appealing to me and might trickle in some way, but when it comes down to it, I think just cartooning is my main love.
Your calling.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really the only thing that I've spent enough time practicing at that I'd have any capacity for.
I think I'm going to play a quick song. We're about 20 past. What would you like to hear? As you know, we start out with the Jay-Z.
Yeah, I'm sure that was, you know, the typical song that everyone expected me to.
it was a nice way to start out. It's like getting like psyched up and stuff.
Right. I can't
keeping
even
it real.
Remember. I can't even remember. I think there's a Nina Simone on there.
Backlash Blues.
Yeah, let's go for that.
Okay, and we will be back in a sec.
Sure.
With Adrian Tomine.
Yep.
I failed probably. Yeah. And we'll be back. Inkset CITR 101.9.
Class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second class fools, Mr. Backlash? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, the world is big, big and bright and round.
Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just what do you think I got to lose? I'm gonna leave you with the backlash blues. You're the one who'll have the blues, not me. Just wait and see.
Ink Stud, CITR 101.9 FM. That was Nina Simone with Backlash Blues. We are joined by our special guest, Adrian Tomanet. And Adrian will be in town at Sophia Books on November 13th, 7 p.m. till 10 p.m. And I guess you can do like a question and answer period while you're there, if I'm correct.
That's right. I think there'll be a little bit of an interview and then open it up to audience questions and then a book signing.
Well, I got a stack of stuff to get signed.
Okay.
I'm just fucking.
No, he's not.
I will be there in attendance, as will Mariel, and it should be a fun event.
Great.
It's nice to have people come to town. Seth did a little signing there, and they're involved with Joe Sacco when he came to town. He fortunately didn't do the signing there. He did it at the library, but
I see.
Still, it's a nice little shop.
I'm looking forward to it.
They have a fine selection of international language books.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, it was important to me to try and go to the independent bookstores on this tour. I think there's a bookstore in Berkeley called Cody's that was just sort of a staple of my existence there, and I spend so much time there. And it just recently shut down, and I think that really kind of was a bit of a wake up call for me about just how dire some of these situations are.
So it's, I'll jump right, you're kind of more focusing on the book market with this than, say, the comic market.
Right.
I guess the book market's a little more receptive than the standard superhero comic store.
Yeah, but there's so many good comic book stores, too, that I've always felt very well supported by. When the comics come out, I think in Optic Nerve, I think that's sort of like basically it's an exclusive to comic shops. You know, there's no bookstore that's gonna file a little 32-page comic on their shelves in the fiction section. So I think that I'm generally gonna promote the comics at comic stores and the books at bookstores.
And that's important too, I understand, the releasing the separate issues.
It is, apparently. I'd sort of didn't realize, but once people started bringing that up, I was thinking, like, yeah, I guess a lot of people have, a lot of cartoonists have abandoned that format and are working directly in towards the big books. People now refer to them as pamphlets.
Yeah, I hate that phrase.
Or floppies, which I think is even worse. But
how about just comics?
Yeah.
Well, I know Paul Hornsheimer, I probably mispronounced his name, but that one's a doozy. He was very frustrated when he did Three Paradoxes because he'd put all this time into it, but he didn't get to see the final product till it was done, so that's why he's releasing Life with Mr. Dangerous in the MoMA anthology, so he can just, get that out there bit by bit.
Yeah, I think I can't speak for him, but I know for me that breaking up Shortcomings into three issues of Optic Nerve was useful for me, just in terms of discipline and sort of creating three more manageable tasks rather than one monumental one. I was talking to another cartoonist recently who has chosen to not serialize his next story, and he was saying that the whole process of just assembling each issue and designing the cover and all that just disrupts his flow too much. And I understand that, but I think for me, I like having a sort of a feeling like there's like this cyclical process where if I can get through this step, then I get to work on the cover, and then when I'm sick of doing covers and letters pages, then I get to start on the next issue. And it all sort of helps me push through.
Kind of sets a schedule for yourself.
Yeah, definitely. It's just one small task at a time.
When doing the story, did that kind of aspect change the way you're doing the story? Like, kind of, you have part of it out and then kind of relook at the ending at all, or is it all pretty planned out?
That's a good question. It was, I mean, I guess, you know, before I even really started drawing the first chapter of it, I had it pretty well planned out. I didn't literally write out every word of it in advance, but I had the plot pretty clearly figured out, and I didn't diverge from that in any way. But I think just whether you're publishing installments or not, I feel like there's just no way of avoiding the fact that it takes much longer to create something like this than it does to read it. So there's a whole, you know, day-to-day real life that's occurring for me as I'm trying to depict this fictional one. So I think, yeah, that I might have felt some impact from the publishing of the earlier chapters, and also, you know, your life changes and you have different experiences that start to color some of the ideas. So it's
reducing jadedness.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, I mean, it's not like a quick painting that's done in a burst of inspiration or a really, you know, a quick pop song that you can record straight to tape or something. It's sort of a very, very slow process.
I'm going to kind of bridge with that process thing is one thing about your work is that the stories, for the most part, I guess, are pretty emotionally painful, it seems. And I don't mean that in like a criticism kind of way. It's the kind of emotion I get from it. It's people going through a lot of pain. And I'm just kind of reflect that my little name dropping. When Chester Brown was on, mm-hmm. he was talking about one thing about his stories is that he's trying to tell a story that is painful for people to talk about. You know, like talking about his early experience with Playboy, mm-hmm. Relationships and stuff like that.
Right.
Is that kind of an aspect where you're going for where it's kind of exploring emotions that aren't necessarily discussed?
I think so. I think, you know, Chester Brown was certainly one of my earliest influences, and he definitely gave me one of my first breaks in a way by plugging my optic nerve mini comic in his comic Yummy Fur, and so I'm sure that some of those methods that he had have affected my work. I think interestingly, I think that he's in a way tried to sort of drain some of the emotion from his, at least his visuals now.
Oh, you're talking about the Louis Riel.
Yeah, I think he's trying to go for a much flatter effect. But you know, I think that that just one of the qualities, whether positive or negative, about alternative comics, which are, you know, generally done all by one hand, is that they sort of lend themselves to a certain intimacy. I think just the working process is very, very insular, and I think the experience of intaking the work is very intimate too. It's not like you know, attending a big rock concert or going to see a movie where there's hundreds of other people reacting audibly. So I think that there is something about it that encourages some of that qualities.
Introspection.
Yeah.
There's one story in particular. When I do interviews, I always prep by rereading the person's, you know, all the work the person has, and there's in the Sleepwalk collection. The story, The Pink Frosting, mm-hmm. that one really struck me as like probably a pretty hard story to be able to just kind of come across because it, I don't know, the emotions in it, it's, I'm trying to think of the right words to describe it.
It's almost like a lot is left up to your own imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was it a difficult story to tell?
You know,
like,
I,
how do you know when to cut it off? Like, how do you know not to not to go right to the end of the story when he goes
right.
home?
I guess, let's see, as to whether that was a difficult story to do, no, I don't think so. I think I enjoyed it in a way as a creative level. It's there's sort of just two levels of engagement with the subject matter that I have when I'm working on it. I mean, there can be times where I'm very much in tune with what the characters are going through, and there can be times when it's quite the opposite. I could be drawing something very downbeat and depressing, but in reality, I'm in a really good, cheerful mood. So, you know, like I said, there's sort of a disconnect sometimes between the pace of real life and the fictionalized one that I'm trying to depict. And that story, to me, felt more like an experiment, and it was sort of interesting for me to see what kind of almost visceral effects could come from. I think it's just two pages, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just it. It's just so concise and complete, but so minimal also, yeah, in other aspects.
Yeah, I think that was the challenge I set for myself. So I enjoyed trying to do that.
I guess that one was also different because you're using different kind of camera angles with it as well.
I haven't looked at it in so long. I'll take your word for it. But I think when you're working with short stories, you can be a little more experimental from story to story. But I feel like with Shortcomings, once I drew that first page, I was pretty much locked into a way of working for the next several years. It was important to me to maintain a consistency within that story. So I would imagine it is different from some of the other shorter pieces.
Now, looking at the optic nerve stuff, it seems like you've kind of created, you know, a concept, a brand with it. I don't like using the term brand, but it is kind of applicable. Is the chance to, now I'm going to quote you here, where you whore yourself out with the commercial work, is that a chance to kind of try a different creative aspect that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for what you're doing with optic nerve?
Sometimes the real creativity is in terms of dealing with other people and knowing how to remain civil while your blood is boiling or knowing when to which fights to pick and when to stand your ground and when to just sort of quietly bow your head down and do as you're told. But I think there's some of that in terms of the art too. I think especially when I have a very good working relationship, as I do with the New Yorker, sometimes I'll feel like, oh, I have this small interior illustration to do, and maybe I'll test out this new brush rather than try and implement it midway through this optic nerve story that I'm working on.
That's with the New Yorker, the covers that you do, they're stunning.
Thank you.
It's actually some of the favorite stuff I'm seeing, especially the bus cover, or the bus out front in Carnegie Hall, which actually influenced someone to write an essay on it. Someone wrote a thing on it I read online talking about, I guess, the girls reading Catcher in the Rye.
I have heard that. I had that specifically in my mind, but people have said that to me.
It's still a stunning piece.
Thank you.
And so with the covers for the New Yorker, are you basically given a carte blanche to kind of come up with like a really emblematic New York portrait,
the interesting thing about working for the New Yorker is that I've found that with the interior illustrations, like for the cinema section, mm-hmm. or the goings on about town, there's a lot of back and forth, and there's a lot of negotiation and revision and things like that, and I've just been lucky, but my experience with the covers is it's kind of either I got it right or I didn't, and there's not a lot of fiddling with it beyond that. They're always with all the ones that I've done. They start with a real basic assignment, like this is the winter fiction issue or something like that. So make it somehow appropriate to that. And then beyond that, I try to just keep in mind that there has to be a little bit of content to it, more than just a pretty picture, like something that you could sort of almost read on a visual level, and you want to tie it into the city and whatever else is specific to that issue. A lot of times it's seasonal. So with the covers that I've done so far, I basically just submitted the sketch, and you know, the ones that they accepted, they said, yeah, just do it.
And you do all the coloring and work yourself, I presume?
I do, yeah. That's the one time in the process where I'm forced to sit down in front of a computer to do the coloring. But, yeah, it's important to me to do all that myself.
The fine world of Photoshop.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting things that you've done, I really want to, I'm fascinated by stuff, and I know I'll never get a chance to interview him because I don't speak Japanese, is your Yoshihiro Tatsumi that you've worked on getting published.
Right.
Tell people about Tatsumi and why he's so important as a creator.
Wow. Well,
that probably could be an hour right there.
Yeah, it is a whole topic, and maybe I'll talk about it more with you when the next book comes out. But briefly, he's... a Japanese cartoonist who's been working professionally since, I think, since the 1950s at a just furious pace. I mean, just, you know, he probably produces more in a day than I produce in a year, basically. He has always been a little bit below the radar, and he was a contemporary of Tezuka,
mm-hmm.
who went on to be...
The
most famous Japanese cartoonist of all time. And at some point, Tatsumi sort of went the other direction and just almost consciously went underground. And as a result, was given a real freedom to do the kind of stories that maybe a more commercial artist would would have second thoughts about publishing. The stories are just very... dark and realistic, and at least the work that we've been translating so far has been just really kind of in the form of short stories, just kind of creating a portrait of the less than cheery side of post-war Japan.
And it's fantastic. Each collection, there's the Pushman and Band in the Old Tokyo. That's just 1 year of his work, right?
Yeah.
Now, is that everything that year, or selections?
No. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Him and Tezuka, did they ever stop? Apparently, Tezuka did a comic on an airplane once.
Right. I've heard that. The difference is that Tezuka had a room full of assistants,
mm-hmm.
and Tatsumi, for at least the bulk of his career, was a one-man operation.
Was it coming across that first collection you found as a young chap in San Francisco, kind of eye-opening, seeing this different kind of Japanese creator? Because I look at a lot of the manga, and I don't like it.
Yeah,
I'll be honest, I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, it's like you know, assuming that you can't read Japanese, you know, it's like we're sort of at the mercy of the American market in terms of what gets translated, and you know, my thinking is that it's possibly like if you showed someone in a foreign country a bunch of you know, Die Hard movies or something, and then they made the determination that they don't like American cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a lot of really great Japanese cartooning, and only some of it has been made available to us here. But yeah, it was definitely eye-opening because. When I was growing up, I think I thought of manga as one of those things that I should love, and just never quite got into. I think when I discovered Tatsumi's work, it was really like two pieces of a puzzle kind of clicking together, because I did enjoy there's a very real Japanese quality to his work, and just, in kind of both.
It's got to feel like some of those earlier Kurosawa movies that weren't the samurai ones, but
I mean, there's no mistaking it for having come from any other country, but at the same time, it to me felt like, you know, this is very much in line with the American underground comics that I was falling in love with too. Of course, I've since learned that Tatsumi was basically unaware of any of those things, but there was something about the two that really connected for me.
Maybe it was a time period, kind of post-atomic age dystopia.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of mutual.
I think so. I think that definitely would have had an impact.
I'm trying to remember that. Jiro Taniguchi is another fantastic Japanese creator.
Yeah.
The Walking Man.
Right.
And a couple of stuff. I'm going to play another song, I think. You got the choice between the Mississippi John Hurt and the Robert Forster.
I'll leave it up to you.
I'm going to go with the Mississippi John Hurt.
Okay.
And we will be back in a sec. Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. And we're chatting with Adrian Tomine, who will be in town November 13th at Sophia Books.
I'm satisfied, tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. I'm satisfied, tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. In the country, then in town, I'm a total old shaker from a neighbor on down. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. I'm satisfied, tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. To my knees, I give my total load of who I please. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. I'm satisfied, tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. Tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back. I'm satisfied, tickled too, old enough to marry you. I'm satisfied, it's gonna bring you back.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is Inkstead, the radio show where we yak about comics. We don't really yak about comics. We yak with comic creators. So maybe that's a bad... I don't know. We yak about comics. We do. Joined by...
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing. Joined by Adrian Tomine. We were just discussing Yoshihiro.
Mm-hmm.
Tatsumi. Is it Yoshihiro?
Yep.
Okay. My Anglo ways didn't mash up his name too badly.
No.
Now... Just one last quick thing with him. You said there's more collections coming out.
Yeah.
Is it going to be, I guess, 1971?
Yeah, I think I'm not positive. The next volume might be 71 and 72 combined, but that's definitely the era, and I think that's some of his best material for sure. It's really pretty heavy stuff. The book's going to be called Goodbye, and it's, I think, the most explicit focus on the just not just post-war in general. There's some very, very specific atomic bomb references and imagery that's pretty disturbing, but very powerful.
It's interesting because it's a subject that, like, North American people just would have no idea of the impact of such a horrific event.
Yeah, and he's as with all his other work, he's approaching that subject matter in a very peculiar and unusual way. It's there's obviously a political edge to it, and there's a lot of anger, but there's still a lot of almost hints of genre influence, like horror and mystery, which you know, lends itself to some pretty easy metaphorical interpretations.
Well, I hope that you will join us when that eventually comes out. I've realized it'll probably be a while.
Yeah, it'll be next year, and I'd love to talk about it in more depth. The project I should mention that we're doing right after that too is we're skipping ahead to his more current work, and in the recent years he's been working on a 1,000-page autobiography.
Oh, geez,
that's what we're gonna dive into.
That's a big book.
Yeah, well, it might have to be several, and then later put in a slipcase or something.
I know Ote Kirihito is.
Yeah,
huge.
How many was that? That was a big book. But
that's probably a good 700 pages or something.
Yeah.
I haven't touched it yet. It's sitting on my bookshelf looking at me, waiting, kind of menacing.
It's a good-looking spine to have looking out from your bookcase. So I love the design that Chip Kidd did.
He's done a great job with those collections.
Yeah.
And Tezuka is someone who I hadn't really gotten into before, but the Buddha stuff I read, I was just like, wow, this is fantastic. So
yeah, I was glad to see recently that they're also going to go back to reprinting his series Blackjack, which I think is his best stuff. So I was disappointed when that kind of the initial translation of that kind of ran out of steam. So I'm glad to see that coming back.
How much stuff are they going to republish by him? Are they just going to do everything eventually?
I doubt that's possible. Yeah.
I don't
know if there's enough trees left in the world to do that.
Scott McCloud was telling me it's about 150,000 pages of comics he did.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting you mentioned that, because I was just remembering recently that when I was a young aspiring cartoonist and I was sending my my work out, my mini comics to people, I remember one day there was just a knock on the door at my parents' house, and the mailman was there with this big box from Scott McCloud, who I'd never met. I didn't know him at all, and I opened it up, and there was a very kind note from him saying, I think you might learn from this, and when you're done with it, send it back to me. And it was a giant box full of Tezuka comics.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's quite the mensch.
Wow.
That was a very generous offer on his part.
So we're coming near the end of our slotted time allotment, so I got about 5 minutes left. So the direct question, what's next?
Well, I've actually finished the work on Shortcomings a while ago, so I've had some time to do other things already. One of the things I dove right into was my contribution to this anthology called Kramer's Ergot.
I think everyone has a piece in that.
I think so. I think it's going to be the book to beat next year, for
it's
sure.
It's got, like, mm-hmm. Al Columbia's in it,
oh, yeah.
Kim Deitch, everyone.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great, and it's huge. It's going to be a gigantic hardcover in full color. And so that was like, the perfect antidote for me after having worked on Shortcomings for so many years to dive into something that was short and contained and just different in every way. It sort of allowed me to bring back a lot of the devices that I'd pared away for Shortcomings. So there's all these sound effects and thought bubbles and narration, and when a car drives away, there's a big puff of smoke in the air.
Vroom.
Yeah, literally. That's
did you the format of it? Just so people know, the book is huge. It's going to be the same size as the Sundays collection, like the Walton Skeezix and the Little Nemo book. Did you get play with that?
Yeah, I did. I the editors told me, why don't you do 2 pages? And I thought, oh, I don't even know if I know how to write a 2-page story anymore. That's so short. And then when I got out my paper and ruler and measured out the dimensions, I realized that, this is actually more like, 10 pages. Because, I thought it would be sort of a ripoff to just draw a regular 2-page story and have the panels just be really big, mm-hmm. and the lettering really giant.
Stencils.
I kept everything proportionally the same and just put a lot more panels onto each page. So I'd say it's definitely the densest 2 pages I've ever done.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people are really using that big format to just try something new and really play with it and stuff.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the idea of Alvin and Sammy, the guys who are putting it out. They might have even made that explicit. And I think it would be hard to approach it and not feel like there were some new opportunities. There's a few panels that I did in the story that are the complete width of the page, you know, so it's a very, very panoramic, widescreen kind of feel, which is something that I could never do in my regular format.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I don't know when that's going to come out, but...
I don't know either. I know there are people who are still working on their contributions. So
I've talked to a couple.
Yeah, which makes me realize that I was given a very fake deadline.
That's the fine world of cartooning, I think. I'm doing an art show, and yeah, I'll leave it there.
So that was the first thing that I dove into right after finishing, and the other thing that I've completed recently was I got married recently.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. And in the planning process, it became apparent to me that there should be wedding favors that are given out. This is something that I was not familiar with at all, and I decided to do something with drawings or with comics. And once I sat down and started working, I got kind of carried away and ended up with a mini comic, I think it's a 20-page mini comic that I printed up and gave away as the wedding favor. and that experience of going back to doing mini comics, both in terms of the format and just in terms of feeling like
the rawness.
Yeah, the rawness, and who cares? No one's going to see this, and I'm doing this for me, and it's not going to be reviewed anywhere. It was a real kind of liberating feeling, and it sort of kind of recharged me a little bit about just the pleasure that you can have in drawing comics, which sometimes you can lose sight of when you're struggling to meet a deadline.
And when you're taking on ambitious projects.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you had a question, Muriel?
So have you started to think about where you wanted to go with Optic Nerve? Like, have you started to think about what kind of story you wanted to tell, or if it's going to be, like, one story per comic, or if you're going to keep continuing with the kind of style of shortcomings where you divided a story up into different parts?
I have been thinking about it a lot. I think I don't think that I'm, immediately ready to dive into another story of the length of shortcomings. I feel like that will require, for shortcomings, I spent probably about a year doing preparation for it and getting it all planned out and everything, and I think that was necessary. So, but at the same time, I am eager to just get back to work and do some drawing. So the plan is probably to do something a little more contained at first before diving into another big pseudo epic, as you said.
I like the term epic, and pseudo is always fun.
Right.
And epic is always three parts, and you got three parts to the story.
True. That's true. I definitely have some plans, and in terms of the subject matter, and I think the fun for me right now is the idea of delving into things that are quite different than what I've been working with the last few years.
Well, we look forward to it.
Thank you.
And I look forward to meeting you.
Okay, I'll see you in Vancouver.
Thank you for taking the time to chat with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we'll see you in a week.
Okay, soon. Sounds good.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That phone line's noisy when I turned it off.
The phone line?
The phone line. Yeah, it's,
the background noise?
Yeah.
Sounded fine on my end.
Yeah. Thank you, Adrian, so much for joining us. That was an awesome chat. We're pretty much out of time now. I felt bad having to cut off, but we're out of time.
Yeah.
The boys from Crimes and Treasons are here.
Boy singular.
Boy!
Where are my boys at?
Where are my boys at? So, like we said before, Adrian will be here November 13th, Sophia Books, 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock. He'll do a Q&A and chat with people.
Oh, my God.
And Muriel's excited. I'm looking forward to meeting him, and I hope you are too as well. This weekend, I got to mention the Vancouver Comic Con at Heritage Hall will be going on. Derek Kirk Kim, James Lloyd, Steve Rolston, and many more will be there hawking their wares. go down and see him. Tell him I say hi. I'll be popping by quick. And next week, my guest will be an interview I did a couple months ago with Patrick Rosencrans, where we discuss the fine work of Greg Irons. Should be an interesting interview. I'm looking forward to it. Or I already did it. So it's an interesting interview.
I will be looking forward to it.
You all should be looking forward to it. And, yeah, check drawnandquarterly.com to see where he is going to be, because, like I said, Adrian is in the middle of a tour. And check out Shortcomings. It's fabulous.
And unfortunately, this show will not be podcast.
It will be podcast.
Really? Oh, yeah. Right, because your dad's recording it.
Hi, Dad. So, yeah, I'll have it up later. I guess, goodbye.
Wanna take a lover, although you're satisfied with me. We have to open our horizons, my love, we can, but you'll do it without me. And you can call me old-fashioned, you can call me straight-laced, but I'm not gonna sit here and let another man take my place. So go and see him, what will be, will be. Every man for the rest of your life will be less than me. I want you to stay, you search for worthwhile need. But why not do the searching around here and try and evolve. There's nothing wrong with us, but what we have here is good. But you have more needs, and the fire cannot burn on the same old wood. So excuse me if I look tired, excuse me if I just look at the sun. You see, I wanted to be blinded, and I wanted to be your only. So go and see him, what will be, will be. Every man for the rest of your life will be less than me. I want you to stay, you search for a worthwhile need. But why not do the searching around here and try and involve me. Time of boredom comes, the dying sound of distant